Now, as I turn to our next speaker, I assume that I could do, and I shall do, in fact, what everyone else does when he approaches him. Namely, I'm utterly convinced that anyone who approaches Mr. Aldous Huxley tells him about one of the books that he has written and which is of particular importance to the person who approaches him. I'm going to do the same, but just in order not to bore him, or to try not to bore him, because I assume he's very bored by that kind of conversation, I shall try to speak of one of his writings, which is the least frequently mentioned, perhaps never mentioned. Now, why should I know about this writing of Mr. Huxley? It's a sheer accident, totally unrelated to our gathering tonight. Some 2 weeks ago, for reasons that have absolutely nothing to do with what we are doing today, I happened to be looking at a collection of etchings by Francisco Goya. It turned out that the introduction to these etchings had been written by Mr. Aldous Huxley. When I say that I was looking at the collection, that's not quite true. I was looking at one special etching, namely one which is in the Capriccio series and which represents a man, it happens that this man is Goya himself, sprawled over his desk in an atmosphere of nightmare with bats, owls, and a sort of wild cats looking at the onlooker. Across the desk where the man is sprawled is written in Spanish something which I had always read to mean the sleep of reason engenders monsters. And as I read over the text that accompanied this etching, I found that Mr. Huxley had an alternative interpretation. He pointed out that the word el sueño in Spanish means not only the dream, the sleep, but also the dream. And he suggested that the caption of the etching is not the sleep of reason and gender monster, but the dream of reason engenders monsters. And in a few sentences, which I quote from memory, he states, in the 18th century, human reason became intoxicated with dreams of progress. Easy progress, endless progress through political freedom and through the easy way of technology. And I must say that this has been with me ever since we gathered here last night, that to a very large extent, the problems that we are agitating come from the fact that the 18th century philosophers have left with us a kind of illusion, a kind of dream, that all the problems of the world can be readily solved merely through the ways of technology. But in fact, it is also clear now that many of our problems are the results of this intoxication of reason. They have given rise to the nightmares, which are those that we have been discussing today. And now, I should like to ask Mr. Aldous Huxley whether he believes that the sleep of reason or the dreams of reason are the most dangerous aspects of modern life. Mr. Huxley.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, let me say that I think both the sleep of reason and the dream of reason are equally dangerous. We can see what nightmares arise from the sleep of reason, from the state in which people refuse to use their rational faculties. And we can also see the terrifying things which arise when, without realizing it, people employ their reason for implementing actions which are dictated by deeply lying unconscious motives. I think this is one of the frightening facts of the modern world, that we see these appalling sub-rational drives of aggression and militarism and nationalism being implemented by the most advanced technology produced by systematic reason. So that I would answer Professor Dubois's question by saying that both these states, the sleep and the dream, are equally dangerous, and that somehow we have to temper the sleep with reason, and at the same time temper the dream with this element which he himself was speaking about yesterday when he quoted the saying of Montaigne that science sans conscience est ruine de l'âme. Science without conscience, without the bowels of compassion and the heart, is the ruination of the soul. That we have to work all the time as entire human beings, not as sub-rational creatures and not merely as rational creatures, but as creatures acting from the totality of the soul, body, spirit. This, I think, is the, whether Goya himself meant this exactly, but I think we can, I don't know, but I think we can interpret this extraordinary picture of his in those terms. And now let me say how touched I am by what the ambassador said about wishing that I had not abandoned poetry. Well, I'm afraid the reason I abandoned it was that I simply don't have what it takes. I would like nothing, I would like more than to be a poet, but unfortunately I do not have that special gift. I'm not a moderately good versifier, but not much beyond that. And now let me point out that even if I were a very great poet, even if I were Shakespeare, I would probably find it virtually impossible to write about the subject which we are talking about tonight. I really would defy Shakespeare to write a sonnet or a tragedy about the population problem. As I was began to say this afternoon, this is really a very serious problem. Here we are faced by something which, as Ambassador Chagla pointed out, is next to the hydrogen bomb the most important issue of our time. And we as artists, the people whose business it is to reflect the world and pass on ideas to people at large, we simply cannot do anything about it, because the this kind of subject matter is simply unsuitable both to the lyric and to the drama, and even to the novel. I very much doubt whether even Sir Charles Snow could make much of a novel about the population problem. And this is a most unfortunate thing, inasmuch as we see that one of the most important issues of our time is actually beyond the scope of those people who ought to be now telling the world how serious the matter is. They can only tell the world how serious it is in forms which are not strictly artistic. They can only tell it in forms of pamphleteering and of abstract information. But it's almost impossible for them to embody this information in a moving work of art, which shall, as a great work of art always does, somehow strike the human being in the heart, in the solar plexus, and move him in his entirety. And I think this is a very painful fact, that these great problems of statistical ethics just do not lend themselves to treatment by the artist. Well, now let me get down to my subject. Let me begin by saying that I've listened to the ambassador's speech with the utmost admiration, and that I can really do very little more than elaborate on his thesis. I can add a few things which, as he was confining himself exclusively to India, I can add material referring to other parts of the world and slightly to enlarge the area which he was discussing. And I think this is worth doing, because obviously this is much more than a problem confined to India. It is a problem affecting the entire world. Now let me begin with a few figures. The ambassador gave some of these figures. I will take the figure which deals with the time it takes for a population to double. Demographers tell us that the population of the planet at the time of the birth of Christ was probably about 250 millions, that is to say, less than half the present population of China. When the Mayflower landed on these shores, the population was about 500 million. That is to say, it took 1,600 years for 250 millions to double their numbers on this planet. Today, we have approximately 3,000 million inhabitants, and the demographers assure us that by the end of the present century, in about 40 years, we shall probably have 6,000 millions. So that we see that whereas a relatively short time ago it took 1,600 years for a very small population to double, it now takes less than half a century for a gigantic population to double. And this obviously shows us what to many, underlines the fact that many people have touched on in the course of these discussions, that we are faced with an entirely unprecedented situation. There is nothing in previous history which remotely resembles the present situation in regard to population. Now, let me come back to this question of doubling time. This 40 years doubling time for world population is based on the assumption that the present rate of increase for the world at large, which is about 1.8% per annum, will persist. It's quite possible that it may rise in the course of the next few years. But assuming that it persists, we shall have a doubling of our population in 40 years. But whereas in certain parts of the world, in Western Europe, for example, the rate of population increase is less than 1%, there are many parts of the world where it is much higher than 1.8%, the average world rate. For example, very near in this hemisphere, we find population increases of 2, 3, and even 4%. In Costa Rica, for example, There will be a doubling of the population in 17 years. And in Mexico, where there are now, I think, about 32 million people, there will be, in 24 years, 64 million people. And this same extraordinarily rapid doubling rate can be found in most of the tropical areas of South America and in certain areas of Asia. In Africa, I think the current rate is probably in the neighborhood of 2% per annum, which means a doubling in about 30-odd years. And of course, as public health measures are brought in, as clean water is brought in and typhoid is therefore reduced, as vaccination is introduced and smallpox is cut off, as efforts are made to get rid of Anopheles mosquitoes and malaria is reduced, we may expect the rate of increase to rise in the course of the next few years. And I was struck this afternoon by what Dr. McDermott said about the inefficacy of public health measures in regard to the reduction of population. Because it seems to me that there is plenty of evidence that these have had profound effect upon population. Indubitably, they had an immense effect upon the increase of population in Europe and this country. It is, after all, only within the present century that the overall rate of population increase in the world reached 1% per annum. And the European increase was undoubtedly due to a very considerable extent to the application of public health measures. And of course, it's extremely simple and cheap to apply some elementary public health measures, even to extremely backward people. 2 years ago, I was in Brazil, and the Brazilian government put a military transport at our disposal and flew us up into the jungle of the Mato Grosso and set us down at an airstrip belonging to the Indian Protection Service. They have an admirable Indian Protection Service in Brazil, where we came across a literally Neolithic tribe, a tribe of savages who had not yet invented pottery or agriculture, who wore absolutely nothing. They were one of the few tribes in the world who go about stark naked, who live mainly by shooting fish with bows and arrows. And I noticed that these people all had vaccination marks on their arms, showing that even in these remote places, this form of public health can be applied without any difficulty. And they were obviously not getting smallpox as they had in the past. So that I think we must admit the fact that the public health measures of a very simple and elementary kind have played a great part in this process, which the ambassador described, of lowering the death rate while the birth rate remains unchanged. And this, of course, leads us to one of the major ethical problems of our time. We have been told, after all, for many, many years, that a good end does not justify bad means. But in this particular context, we find this paradoxical situation that essentially good means may lead, among other things, to very bad ends. There's this tragic thing that when we do what is obviously intrinsically good, save people from malaria, save people from smallpox and bilharziosis and so on, and this is admirable. But then we find that we keep many more people alive and that their last state may be worse than the first. What is the answer to this problem? Obviously, we can't stop health measures. We can't refuse to give these people protection against these horrifying diseases. The only answer, it seems to me, is that science should take one further step, exactly as Ambassador Tragler has suggested, and attempt to bring into balance the birth rate with the death rate. And I think here in this whole problem of ethics, I think it would be very important to bring up children with the idea that many of the fundamental ethical principles of civilized life do go right down into the world of non-human nature. After all, the golden rule goes down into the world of inanimate nature. Do as you would be done by. If you want nature to treat you well, you must treat nature well. If you choose to treat nature in such a way that erosion sets in, nature will treat you extremely badly. And in the same way, the whole idea of Greek morality, the idea of balance, the idea of moderation, the idea of nothing to excess, is really paralleled by the natural system of checks and balances which goes throughout the whole of animate life in nature. The system of checks and balances are enforced by nature in ways which we cannot accept. They are enforced by mutual devouring and by disease and famine. And our problem is to find humane equivalents for these checks and balances in order to produce this state of equilibrium, which is the natural condition under which animal species can live and under which alone they can live satisfactorily. Well, now, I would like to speak first about the consequences of a rapidly growing population in a very advanced, technologically advanced country. In the United States, the current rate of population increase is just about the same as it is for the world at large. It's, I think, about 1.7%, which will mean a doubling of the population in 40 years. And if this rate of increase is continued until the year 2050, the population of the United States will be 1 billion. Needless to say, this increase will not continue at that rate. I think this has been clearly demonstrated by the fact which was brought out by Dr. Dubose this afternoon, that there have been great fluctuations in the rate of increase in America in the last 20 years or so. During the Depression, the increase was less than 1% per annum. It was 0.7% per annum. In the 40s, it rose to about 1.2% and has now risen to about 1.7%, but shows slight signs in the last year of falling again. This means that the possibility of controlling the population, population increase, is within the means of this population. And the same is true, of course, of almost all Western populations. As Dr. Dubose pointed out, the French increase was incredibly small in the 1930s and is now very considerably larger than it was. And there are certain other countries which are in a position to control their population. One of the most startling examples in recent years has been the halving of the birth rate, which has taken place in Japan simply as a result of a voluntary decision by the Japanese people to stop this terrifying increase which menaced the complete ruin of the inhabitants of those extremely mountainous and overpopulated islands. But this kind of possibility of changing the rate of increase exists, as far as I can see, only for people with a high degree of education, a high degree of social discipline, and a considerable advance in technology. I think it simply does not. Such a possibility at present hardly exists for the people in underdeveloped countries. It looks as though they were, under present circumstances, almost condemned to go on increasing at the same rate. It will require, I think, a tremendous effort of education and propaganda to cause these people to change their ways. It is, of course, extremely hopeful that the Indian government has adopted family planning as one of the planks of its five-year plan. The only trouble is, as the ambassador pointed out, is that the resources available permit such a very small beginning to be made. I forget what the number of villages in India is. I think it runs to 300,000 or 400,000. And as the ambassador told us, at the end of 5 years, there will be 8,000 birth control centers, so that we see how colossal the task is in front of any hitherto underdeveloped nation which wishes to inculcate the principles of family planning. Well, now let us come back to the consequences of this rather rapid increase which is going on in this country. One of the consequences, as Professor Spengler of Harvard has pointed out, is undoubtedly that the rise in the standard of living will certainly not be as great in consequence of the population increase as it would have been if the increase had been less substantial. A great deal of the resources made available by increased productivity will simply have to go partly to the replacement of obsolete houses and instrumentation, and also simply to satisfy the needs of the new population which has come into existence. Then there is another very serious and difficult problem. This is the problem of education. There are difficulties already. We've seen in the last few years the overcrowding of schools, the insufficiency of teachers, the fact that in many elementary schools there have to be several shifts of the children. And what we're going to see in the 60s is the same thing happening on an even larger scale in the high schools and universities. It's apparently anticipated that there will be something like a 45% increase of enrollment in the high schools, and probably a 90% increase of enrollment in the universities. Well, this will mean that in the coming decade, education will be conducted almost in an atmosphere of crisis and of panic. I was happy to hear from Dean Jensen that Dartmouth hopes to remain small and to keep up its standards to the highest possible pitch. But, of course, like the hero of the Ibsen's Master Builder, it will certainly hear the younger generation knocking at the door. It may wish to keep small, but whether it will be able to, in the face of the mounting floods of people who want a university education and perhaps don't care too much whether that education is of a very high standard, it remains to be seen whether Dartmouth will be able to resist this clamor of the new population. Now, another peculiarity which this increase of population will have in this country, and indeed in most countries, will be this. The great increase of population will be in the cities. There will be an enormous increase in urbanization. Something like 3/4 of all the inhabitants will be living in cities of more than 100,000, and some immense number, I forget what it is, will be living in one or other of the 10 super cities which demographers foresee for the end of the present century. It's worthwhile enumerating what these super cities will be and what their numbers will be. There will be a super city in Florida of Miami, Palm Beach, of about 9 million. There will be a super city of Washington, Baltimore, also about 9 million. There will be an 8 million city around Philadelphia. There will be a 23 million super city of New York, about an 8 million super city of Boston. There will be a baby super city around Cleveland of only about 6 million, about 10 million around Chicago, 20 million around Los Angeles, and about 8 million around San Francisco. Now, we may well ask, what sort of effect will this immense increase in urbanization have on the quality of individual life? Only too frequently people talk about increases of population solely in terms of the available food supply. Well, the United States will certainly have plenty of food for a good time to come. But after all, it has been said that man does not live by bread alone. He has to live by many other things. And the question arises, what quality of life will there be in these heavily congested urban areas? I myself, I feel it already, that it seems to me extremely bad for children to be brought up in these immense urban areas where they are totally out of touch with nature. There are innumerable children who have never seen a cow. And I have a little great-nephew in Paris whom I saw a couple of years ago and who had been taken out into the country and had seen a hawk circulating in the sky and had pointed up and said, avion, avion, airplane, airplane, you see. And this was the only thing he knew. He'd seen airplanes flying over Paris. But this, I think, this makes one laugh, but I think it is a very serious matter when human beings live in a wholly homemade atmosphere and in homemade surroundings and not in any kind of touch with the natural world. Then, of course, numerous sociologists and psychologists have spoken of the strange psychological effects of living in these great cities which have no real community sense at all. Baker Brownell, for example, has written on it. Arthur Morgan has written on it. David Riesman in The Lonely Crowd has written on it. Eric Fromm has written on the same theme. I think perhaps some of this these complaints may be exaggerated, but nevertheless, it does seem quite likely that this bringing up in totally non-natural conditions with these atomized individuals in only a functional and not in a personal relationship with one another may produce very serious psychological effects. One of the problems which is already facing us at this time is the problem of delinquency. Well, even if the delinquency rate should not rise, and many people think that it will rise with the increasing urbanization, the absolute number of delinquents, considering that the age group from which delinquents are drawn will double, will be twice as great towards the end of the century as it is now. And this alone will cause a great deal of disturbance and discomfort in our world. So that we see that even in a country as well equipped as this one for coping with these problems, there will be enormous interior consequences in regard to the quality of life. Then there is a point which has been brought out in more than one of his books by Harrison Brown in The Challenge of Man's Future and in the Next 100 Years, the point that as population goes up And as technology advances, the drain on the unreplaceable resources of this country will, of course, increase. The drain has already wiped out the easily accessible ores of many minerals, and many of these minerals have to be imported already. And it seems quite likely that in regard to easily accessible rich ores, the United States will be a have-not country within another 20 years. Well, this will certainly create the necessity for a complete change in foreign policy. At the worst, I hope it will never come to that, at the worst it could mean a kind of desperate imperialism in order to try to get the necessary raw materials. And at the best, which I hope, it will mean a much closer cooperation with other countries than at the present is contemplated. But in either case, there will be profound changes, I think, in the foreign policy of this country, owing to the fact that the enormously increased consumption of these irreplaceable materials will cause the United States to depend more and more on foreign countries for its supplies. Well, now let us pass from the consequences of a rapid population increase in a highly developed country to the consequences of a rapid population increase in underdeveloped countries. Here, the whole situation is well illustrated by a parable which can be drawn from Alice through the Looking Glass. You will remember there that Alice and the Red Queen at one point start running, and they run for a very long time, as fast as they can. And when they stop running, Alice is amazed to find that they are in exactly the same place that they were when they started. And she expresses her surprise at this and says, "In my country, when we run as fast as this, we get somewhere." And the Red Queen says, "Well, yours must be a very slow country. Here, if we want to stay still, we have to run as fast as we can. And if we want to get somewhere else, we have to run twice as fast." And this, tragically enough, is the situation of many underdeveloped countries now. They can, if they want to maintain their substandard standard of living, subsistence standard of living, they have to run as fast as they can. They must do a tremendous amount of work in increasing agricultural production and industrial production, merely in order to maintain their present situation. And if they want to go somewhere else to improve their lot, they have to run a good deal faster than they think they can run. And the problem in relation to the most underdeveloped countries simply is it possible for people in a completely backward and totally underdeveloped country to run twice as fast as they can? Tragically, I think in many cases, it will not prove to be possible. Actually, in recent years, the FAO has reported some evidence that in certain countries, the amount of food and of goods available to individuals today is actually less than it was 40 years ago. And quite recently, UNESCO published figures showing that in spite of the immense efforts which have been made all over the world to combat illiteracy, the absolute number of illiterates is greater than it ever was before. Here again we see a picture of the running as fast as possible in order not quite to stand in the same place. Consider, for example, what a country with a population increasing at 3% per annum has to do in order to increase its standard of living and its standard of culture. It first of all has to in order to stand still, it has to increase its agricultural and industrial capacity by 3% per annum. In order to achieve any noticeable improvement in the standard, it has to increase its agricultural and industrial production by a minimum of 4%, and preferably by 5% or more. Now, this, of course, requires a great deal of technical skill and an enormous amount of capital. Now, capital, of course, in the underdeveloped countries is precisely what is lacking. For after all, what is capital? Capital is what is left over when the needs of the population have been satisfied. But in most of these countries, the needs of most of the population are never satisfied, and consequently there are no savings and virtually no capital. It's been calculated that there is, in the average highly developed Western country, there is at least 70 times as much capital as there is in not in the most underdeveloped countries, but in a pretty underdeveloped country. This is a situation which illustrates perhaps what is perhaps the most depressing remark in the Gospels, the remark that to those who have shall be given, and from those who have not shall be taken away even that which they have. And when we look at this situation and ask ourselves what is to be done, we see that in fact there are only two alternatives. One is that the underdeveloped country which wants to develop and to raise its standard of living must be supplied with capital from the outside, from countries which have a surplus of capital, or alternatively they must do what the ambassador tells us that India is trying not to do, and thank God it is trying not to do, make use of forced labor as capital, because you can use human beings as expendable counters in lieu of capital to a very considerable extent. And the great problem, I think, which confronts the world is whether the underdeveloped countries can achieve this improvement in their way of life without resorting to this substitute for capital, which is totalitarian control and the forced labor of the masses. I would like to quote some remarks made by Sir John Boyd Orr, now Lord Orr. He made, about 5 or 6 years ago. He said, "There is only a 50-50 chance of getting over this food problem. If it is not solved, there will be chaos in the world in the next 50 years. The nations of the world are insane. They are spending 1/3 of their national income preparing for the next war. They are applying their energies to building up a war machine instead of applying the world's steel and industrial products to conserving the resources of the land, which is the only basis of civilization." I think this probably remains perfectly true today. This was said, as I say, a few years ago, but I don't think the situation has materially changed since then. And that Lord Orr is probably right in saying that there is about a 50-50 chance of getting over this terrible problem of raising the standard of living without resorting to forced labor. And of course, even under the most favorable circumstances, it is not at all certain that there will be a success. I mean, I think what we shall see is this Alice in Wonderland, Alice through the looking glass, picture of desperate efforts resulting only in standing in the same place. We shall see at the same time the terrible spectacle of what is called mining the soil in the desperate effort to provide food for these increasing multitudes, the farmers will destroy the soil from which this food is derived. We've already seen the terrible increase of erosion over large areas of the world, and as the population causes people to become more desperate, I think we shall see yet more of this process. Then we shall see increasing urbanization in the underdeveloped countries, and since there is not enough capital to provide adequate housing in these countries, we shall see an immense increase in the slum conditions of living. UNESCO published figures the other day pointing out that there were probably 150 million families in Southeast Asia living in rural or urban slum conditions, and this number is likely to be greatly increased. Now, needless to say, this state of affairs is likely to have very serious political consequences. With the frustration of the extremely high hopes with which all the newly independent nations have come into existence, there will grow up a sense of horrible disappointment, which will, I think the consequences of this will be a social unrest at home, an intense envy and dislike of more fortunate nations abroad, and in certain circumstances, I think, a tendency towards aggressive action in regard to nations held to have greater resources than the one which is feeling this pinch of frustration. And it's worthwhile pointing out that we are discovering now that it is perfectly possible for an underdeveloped country, provided it gets a certain amount of aid from abroad and provided it can impose forced labor upon its millions, it is perfectly possible for it to remain a country mainly peopled by men and women on a subsistence level and yet to become a first-rate military power. It is possible to put the entire emphasis of industrial development into heavy industry and the creation of armaments. And this possibility, which I don't think was ever understood or realized until quite recently, of course poses an appalling threat, particularly in the context of the Cold War. Nobody has any idea of what consequences this may have. Now, we must finally ask ourselves what can be done. Speaking of the matter in ethical terms, we can ask the question, how can biological facts be reconciled with humanitarian ideals? Can we find humane and acceptable substitutes for nature's methods of balancing balancing non-human populations by means of hunger, disease, and among certain species of ants and among human beings, because these are the only creatures which make war, also by war? Can we find these more humane substitutes? This is the problem. Now, there are quite obviously two things which can be done. One is to do everything possible to increase production, both of food and of industrial resources. Now, it is quite obvious that while the more prosperous parts of the world are spending about $100 billion a year on armaments, the problems of the underdeveloped countries simply cannot be solved. I would like very much to see a Gallup poll conducted among all the inhabitants of the earth asking the question, which do you prefer, to have enough to eat or to have nationalism and armies? And I think that if this question were honestly asked, the majority of people would probably say they would prefer to have enough to eat. But it would have to be stressed that they are not going to be able to have both. I don't think they are going to be able to have both. And that as long as, in the words of Lord Orr, the nations remain insane, it is very unlikely that this 50-50 possibility of solving the overpopulation problem will be realized. Then, of course, it's quite clear that whatever efforts are made to increase production, they will never, if the rate of increase continues indefinitely as it is, be sufficient to catch up with the enormous increment of human births over deaths. And therefore, it will become necessary, as the ambassador pointed out, to introduce some system of birth control. Now, this is a good deal easier said than done. Death control is remarkably cheap and simple, for the very obvious reason that you can control infectious diseases with a handful of experts. All that's required, for example, to get rid of, say, smallpox, is to go around and give, vaccinating people. All that you need for getting rid of typhoid is to dig wells, as was done in Egypt, when several thousand artesian wells were dug in the delta in the 1940s, with the result that the smallpox incidents, the typhoid incidents, fell enormously. And it is quite relatively easy even to get rid of malaria, which requires a few trained doctors, a good many gallons of DDT, and a number of, quite a small number of workmen to spread the DDT on the swamps. But when you come to the, first of all, the problem of increasing production, and then the problem of decreasing the birth rate, you find that you are up against the problem of educating enormous numbers of people. To increase the production of food, you have to educate millions of peasants to change their habits, to introduce new forms of technology. And in order to change the reproductive habits of great numbers of people, you have to have an educational campaign affecting, say, 1,000 million couples. Well, perfectly obviously, this is an extremely difficult and arduous problem. Unless it is faced, and faced with some degree of success, we shall see, as Lord Orr said, chaos in the world within 50 years. We shall probably. Say 1,000 million couples. Well, perfectly obviously, this is an extremely difficult and arduous problem. Unless it is faced, and faced with some degree of success, we shall see, as Lord Orr said, chaos in the world within 50 years. We shall probably not see it before then, but this it becomes increasingly necessary, as has been pointed out on several occasions in these discussions, it becomes increasingly necessary for us to become aware of the remoter future and to do something about that future. It is not enough to say, as was said by, I don't know who was the person who originally said it, why should I do anything for posterity? What has posterity done for me? It says posterity has done nothing for us. But at the same time, if we care at all about the human race, then we have to take thought for the morrow. We have to take thought for what is going to happen 20 or 30 years from now. And clearly, what is required, as the ambassador points out, is, if possible, the production of an oral contraceptive, of what in popular language is called the pill. But fortunately, the production of the pill and the administration of it is a multiple problem. It is first of all a problem in chemistry, then it's a problem in medicine, then it's a problem in psychology, in sociology, in education, and even in theology. So that we have to attack this problem on many fronts at once. And incidentally, the pill isn't here. The only oral contraceptives that are here are very expensive, have to be taken every day, and have unpleasant side effects in many cases. So that we are still quite a long way away from this ideal method of family planning. And another thing which has to be remembered is that none of this, even if we get the pill, and even if by some miracle the birth rate were reduced overnight, say by 20%, there would still be, for the next generation or so, very formidable increases in population, for the simple reason that the number of people in the reproductive age group is so very great at the present time, that this huge number, even if their birth rate were 20% less than the birth rate that exists at the present time, this great number would produce vast numbers of children. So that nobody must imagine that this campaign of family planning is going to produce immediate results. It will not produce results, probably, in less than about a generation. But unless it is adopted, the consequences will be beyond that generation, I would imagine, and as I think most demographers would agree, completely disastrous. And here we have to remember that time is against us. We have to act with the greatest possible speed in this matter. Otherwise, the future fate of mankind may be completely disastrous. And we shall then see what Lord Orr calls chaos, and what I would call, in the context of this talk, a serious deterioration of the whole quality of human life due to this breakneck increase in quantity. Thank you.
Mr. Aldous Huxley has not made very clear whether it was more comfortable for you to let your reason sleep or enjoy its nightmares.